This is Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
On November 6, 2007, voters in the city of Charlottesville will go to the polls to elect three members of the city council. This recording is Sean Tubbs' September 4th interview with Barbara Haskins, an independent candidate in the race.
Barbara Haskins, thank you for participating in this interview with Charlottesville Tomorrow. The complete audio and written transcript for this interview will be available on the internet. Information from this interview will be used in the compilation of Charlottesville Tomorrow's nonpartisan voter guide. Charlottesville Tomorrow does not endorse any candidates, and our goal is to provide information to the public so they can make an informed vote on issues related to land use, transportation, and community design. As you are aware, some of the questions you will be asked have been provided in advance, while others have not. All city council candidates will be asked the same questions. Are you ready to start?
I am, and good morning, Sean. Thank you for doing this.
Question one. Please describe your past experience that qualifies you to be on city council.
I would say there's three elements of my experience that are relevant to that question. First of all, I've been head of my treatment team for 20 years. I've worked in an actual state bureaucracy. So I have decades of experience of having to interface with a variety of regulatory agencies, a variety of funding streams, a variety of rules, and a variety of constituent groups, and have had to work in that model to get things done. So I think it's important for people to understand I have not been in private practice for 20 years. I've worked in the state system and am very familiar with competing constituencies and conflicting needs and priorities. So I would say that would be the first piece. And then the second piece is for many years at the hospital, I was chair of medical quality assurance. And I think there are some important constructs that are relevant. Namely, if you look at the whole idea of TQM, total quality management, the core idea there is, or one of them, is that the people who are closest to the process are really the experts on how to improve the process. And what we have in the city are a lot of city staff and hired consultants who spend many, many, many work hours on a given assignment or project or idea or question. And generally speaking, they're the closest to the process. And then they bring their recommendations forward to groups like City Council. And I think sometimes City Council overreaches itself in questioning the work product of that group. And I just think that one should be very wary of doing that because, generally speaking, those are the people on the ground in the trenches who understand the ins and outs of the question at hand. So that would be my second answer, is a really, I think, very deep appreciation of when you question something that's brought forward by the people who are in the best position to know the answer to the problem, you should be asking yourself, why is it that I'm questioning that? And then thirdly, I've also been on the Hospital Medical Executive Committee for 13 years, and it was our job, again, to look at policy recommendations, look at problems in the system, look at coming regulatory changes or mandated changes or changing populations, and really figure out the best solution for problems that are often thrust upon us rather than generated ourselves. We also had to solve those, but in a bureaucracy or in a governmental type system, you're more likely to have problems thrust upon you than to be generating the things you're dealing with. So I would say those three things are my experiential background that I think would make me capable of serving on city council.
Question number two. In June of 2006, the city and county signed off on a 50-year water supply plan that includes a new dam at the Ragged Mountain Reservoir and a new pipeline connecting it to the South Fork Rivanna Reservoir. Do you support this plan? Why or why not?
And this would be an example of what I was just talking about, where you've had many, many people working many, many hours who brought a lot of expertise to the question. I know there were dueling constituencies, and the people that were affected by the various water proposals had very strong opinions, and they all weighed in during the process. So because there's been this expert panel convened to really look at the solution, and they have recommended this as the best option, then I would support it, because they're the people who we delegated to address it. And I think it's counterproductive to question it at this point. I see no red flags. There are problems in the solution, but almost every issue has an upside and a downside. And for me, the problem in this issue really speaks to sort of the second part of why I'm running, which is, does it make sense to be the city the way the city is currently constructed? We have endless boundary issues and turf wars with the county. And the question I'm trying to raise in my campaign is it productive for the community at large in the long run to be having these kind of endless territorial squabbles? In the case of Ragged Mountain Reservoir, that city land that we're going to have 142 acres flooded, and so cities losing city hiking area and natural area for habitat. And the question is, how do you replace that in terms of the recreational value, let alone the habitat value? And then immediately the squabble starts, you know, with the water authority, the city, and the county. Where do you get the land to replace it, and who pays for it? And it's a little ironic, because these are all governmental agencies that are sort of birthed by the will of the people. So for some reason, it's sort of like in Greek mythology, when the gods are born from the forehead of Zeus and then they fight with each other. I mean, on one level, there's a little bit of an absurdity here. But on a practical level, there's still a problem of where is the replacement land coming from and who's paying for it. And once again, the city is sort of falling on the grenade in terms of taking a tangible hit for a process that may or may not directly affect the city. In the case of the water, the consensual agreement seems to be that our development needs are rather static and flat line in the city. It's the county where all the growth is occurring. It's the county that needs more water. So we're losing the parkland for county water, and as long as there's this boundary between us, it's a problem. And replacing it's a problem, too, replacing the parkland. So hopefully you think I've answered your question.
Question number three. In addition to community concerns about an adequate water supply to accommodate growth and prepare for droughts, the Rivanna Water and Sewer Authority is also anticipating significant investments in upgraded sewer infrastructure. In general, what will the financial impact be on ratepayers, including the University of Virginia, for public water and sewer to complete the 50-year water supply plan and update and expand our aging sewer facilities?
Well, you know, the short answer to that is it's going to cost what it's going to cost. And I think what would interest me more specifically, and I'm not on that committee, I don't know the numbers, but they're going to charge what it costs to replace it. And all the consumers are going to have to pay for that. And the sort of specific question will be, is the cost equitably distributed? There's been a lot of battles with the Solid Waste Authority about whether the cost is equitably distributed among the three players of the city, the county, and the university. So one could imagine a recreation of that same squabble. But for me, the issue is taking care of infrastructure. And I think that as a society, we've done a very poor job of being level-headed and mature in our financial decision-making. I think that governmental spending priorities reflect personal spending priorities. And in the last several decades, we've moved more and more towards a conspicuous consumption-oriented society, so that people have disposable income and they elect to spend it on something visible, whether it's a flat-screen TV or a ATV or, I mean, you pick it. There's just no end of what you can buy. At perhaps the neglect in personal circumstances, people neglect personal savings and are living on credit card debt. But society has also made spending decisions that have not supported infrastructure. This is nobody, it's not a secret, not a surprise. The bridge falling down in Minnesota is just the most recent example. So I think it's a hallmark of a mature governmental agency that can put aside enough of the disposable income to prudently meet the needs for infrastructure maintenance. I know that the city has a capital development fund, and some funding streams for it in addition to grants to support this kind of infrastructure replacement. The city's sewers are old. They leak a lot of stormwater. A lot of stormwater gets into the city sewer system that, if it weren't there, would be less of a burden on the water treatment facilities. And also there'd be less overflow during storms of this sewage into the water supply. There are solutions for fixing the aging infrastructure of the city's sewers, but there has to be a 5-year plan, 10-year plan, whatever. There has to be a willingness to do that, a political will on the part of the people that are responsible for it.
Question number 4, if you're ready to move on. How would you define quality growth for our community?
This question comes up over and over, and the more I've thought about it, the more I've decided that there's no such thing as quality growth per se. And I would say somewhat ironically and facetiously that quality growth is like Prince Charming for women. Women might have an idea in their mind who Prince Charming is, and he would have, 100 positive attributes, none of which you'd argue with, and you'd want all 100. But you're not going to meet Prince Charming, and quality growth starts to approach that. I mean, it kind of starts to get to the level of an oxymoron, because people have so many strong opinions about change and development that hardly any kind of growth is going to be quality growth. There's clearly growth that could be not quality growth, an all-night poker joint with a strip bar attached in the middle of a residential neighborhood. I know that's not possible by zoning, but I mean, there's a lot of things we could agree. Well, that's definitely not quality growth. But defining what quality growth is, I think, is much more of an aspiration in the mind. I mean, it's not really going to happen the way people want it to happen. There's not going to be a lot of consensus on most projects. And I would contextualize that further by saying that in our economic system, there are real constraints on that notion, because we have an economic system set up on the rights of property owners, and that's just the way it is. Maybe people don't like that, but it's true. So if property owners have, within their zoning laws, an ability to do what they want with their property, then of course they're going to make decisions that other people don't like. I think if you were going to try to capture the notion of quality growth, you would be talking about infrastructure support and aesthetically pleasing. Although, again, if you just think of the Picasso statue in Chicago in front of their office building. You know, he put out this radical statue. Half the people hated it, half the people loved it. So even though if I say quality growth should have an aesthetic component, there's still going to be disagreement. Certainly for me, I would hope that we can maintain some of the visual quality of our area. I drove past UVA Hospital this weekend on my bike, and it's still ugly. You know, it was ugly when it was built. It's still ugly. It's like a giant white Band-Aid or something, big, gauze 4x4. So one hopes that things that are built are pleasing to the eye, but that's in the eye of the beholder. And I hope that there can be preservation of our canopy and some feel for natural spaces within the development that occurs.
Question number 5. Do you support the Meadow Creek Parkway, which VDOT plans to advertise for construction in 2008? Why or why not?
And this goes back to what I said for the first question, which, again, there have been thousands and thousands and thousands of work hours over many, many years applied to the question of this problem. And the consensus has been, build it. You know, here's where the road should go, and here's why, et cetera. So I think I'm going to respect the people that made that decision and support it. And again, all these kind of decisions have upsides and downsides. This one's no exception. There are pros and cons to it, but I think the pros outweigh it. You and I could spend the next hour just talking about the parkway. So I won't, but I'll tell you some of the things I'm thinking. A lot of people feel it will move traffic between points in the county, which immediately, for me, goes right back to, again, and why do we have a city and a county? You know, if it's one community, it doesn't matter. When there's dueling political entities, it matters. And it's it becomes a bone of contention, a symbolic reason to throw down the gauntlet. The downtown business owners and merchants, and you know, we rest on the backs of people who are in free enterprise and people who expend their personal and financial capital to run businesses. That's what keeps us going forward. They want the parkway. They believe it will be important to have some kind of reasonably unfettered way to get downtown. I would like to defer to their preference in this regard because I want to support them. And without the business people who are the core of the mall, you know, we lose a profound part of our character. You know, other people would say it's not going to be to come downtown. It's going to go county to county. I don't have a crystal ball. I think it'll be both. But the harder it gets to travel on every other road, the more that is a disincentive for people who did want to come downtown. I think that, you know, there are criticisms about the Eastern Connector. I've seen some of the county's responses. They make sense in terms of road building is a multi-staged process. They're not sure what the route would be. They're not sure is it the scope of the connector. They've allocated funds to proceed in that regard. So, again, I am not throwing down the gauntlet to the county and saying, oh, yeah, well, then we're not building the road. From what I understand, VDOT now has guidance that they're supposed to include bicycle and pedestrian access on these new roads that they're putting in. And I think that those bicycle and pedestrian pathways running that distance are a wonderful asset to the community. You just have to look at the GW Parkway up in Northern Virginia that goes from D.C. to Mount Vernon. They have a bike path. And on the weekends, you practically need stoplights. It's so used. I mean, people love it. People get out there and use it. And it's, again, it's the way we do things here, that we tend to put those bikeways and pedestrian pathways next to roads. So since we do that, good, we're going to get more bikeways. Also, I think, and I know some people are throw tomatoes at me, I think that the bypass in Charlottesville is a beautiful road. As roads go, it's gorgeous. Parks and Rec do a fabulous job of planting there with the azaleas and the flower beds. We have the art in place on that road. It's missing bike trails and pedestrian byways. But aesthetically, it's very nice. And I think that from what I saw of the Meadow Creek Parkway plans, it's a curving road. It has a very low speed limit on it. There's a lot of opportunity for aesthetic potential as roads go, which is, you know, actually a plus. A lot of roads are built with zero aesthetic in mind. And I think we're going to have a high aesthetic factor. And, you know, I just want to say I live near where it's going in. So I've walked in those woods sort of behind the CHS football field for 17, 18 years. And as soon as I heard about the parkway, I started to be sad. So I understand what's being lost, too. But there is replacement parkland going in. Again, there are upsides and downsides, and I think the upsides outweigh the downsides for this road.
Okay. Moving on to question number 6. What are your overall transportation priorities for the city of Charlottesville?
Well, again, here we right. You know, everything comes back to this, which is the second piece of my campaign, is do we want to keep the city-county boundaries that we currently have? Do we want to continue to do business as two largely separate entities? I know there's some cooperation, but there's a lot of non-cooperation and, you know, that's mine, not yours. No, I'm not paying for that because you benefit. So, you know, are we going to look at this question and say, specifically only in the city of Charlottesville, what are the transportation issues? Or is that kind of silly? And really what we need to be talking about is a regional priority for transportation. In the city, I was bike riding this weekend, and I went to look at a development, Cherry Hill. And when you get near UVA, the bike paths just disappear. And there's certain big intersections where you really lose that non-vehicular right-of-way. If you're not in a vehicle, you've lost your right-of-way, and you're sort of back to taking your chances. So I think there's a few intersections. Same thing when you're going past Snyder tennis courts. You know, you're kind of on your own, crossing your fingers till you get to the bike path on the other side. Those would be city things. I know that there's part of the strategic plan is to have all the schools have sort of non-vehicular trails for 2-mile radius, I think, so that children within 2 miles could get to school using bikes or on foot if they wanted to. That's a wonderful plan. And God bless the Ravana Trails Foundation for all the work they've been doing in making a loop of trails around the city and the county. You know, the regional thing, I think, comes again later in this interview. You're going to ask me more regional transportation questions, so I may not go too much into the bigger picture right now. I guess nobody likes traffic jams, and everybody wants somebody else to stop driving their car. And whether we're talking just in the city or in the metropolitan area, the question is, when do you seduce people into an alternative form of transportation? And our system, again, we don't like pull people's driver's licenses so there'll be fewer cars on the road, you know. We have incentives, and so at some point people have to feel there's a juicy alternative to taking their cars. You see in the paper nice little stories about people that get Vespas for buzzing around downtown. That's great. They thought it made sense for them. A lot of people haven't made that decision yet. But I think if it's all right with you, I'll defer the rest of this till we get to the bigger question.
Well, question number 7, what are your views on working more closely with the county and the University of Virginia to jointly operate a regional transit system? What will you do to promote the use of public transportation, pedestrian trails, and bike paths?
Okay, well, there's, you know, that's cheating. There are about 8 questions in there. And you'll have to remind me if I don't get all 8 of your embedded questions there. Obviously, as I just mentioned, the Meadow Creek Parkway should be having bike and pedestrian trails, so that'll open up some miles of usage. And I just talked about the intersections that non-vehicles have no clear access lanes. You know, UVA, I was just talking about Prince Charming. UVA is sort of like the big castle on the hill, and it has a drawbridge, and it lets that bridge up and down as it sees fit. And they were just talking, you know, this weekend in the Progress about transportation. And UVA was saying how they have their own system, they have their own schedule, they can run buses frequently, they have a smaller area, they have a lot of riders. They made perfect sense. And all of these transportation questions on one level come down to the same thing of the providers and consumers have to think it makes sense. So right now, I can understand UVA saying, we have a system that works well. And what is the guarantee that by joining a larger system, we're not just hurting ourselves? Which is the same thing as a car rider says, what is the guarantee by me taking a bus that I'm not just hurting myself? So I think if you're talking about transportation, and again, I just want to put in a statement that says, my whole issue is, should the city stay the city the way it is? Should there be some kind of dissolution of boundaries or complete merger, et cetera, et cetera? And I think that these kind of questions come up every so many years, and I'm hoping to really be a catalyst for that question being put front and center now. I think the ambulance brouhaha with the subsequent formation of a task force to look at emergency response system is an example of a one-sided decision. Let's make a new city ambulance program. Then because of the outcry being changed into a regional panel of experts trying to solve the problem. So transportation is another area. Every area is like this just about of, well, why do we have 2 different entities? But having said all that, I think you have 2 different populations you're talking about. One are the people that lack access to a vehicle. And for them, buses or taxi cabs are their main way of wheeled transport. And for those people, the goal would be to give them enough access to their destinations in somewhat of a user-friendly fashion, including Sundays, which I know they've just started, which is a good thing. Because nobody thinks it's fair to have to spend a half a day to run an errand, which I think was the anecdote in the paper this weekend, you know, 6 hours for 2 stops. It's ridiculous, which is partly why people haven't gotten out of their cars and into the bus, because that's what they think, too, 6 hours for 2 stops. Mm-hmm. So once you start talking about moving people out of their vehicles into buses, people are more likely to be seduced into it than punished into it. Now, you can punish people by really making parking more expensive, or you can open HOV lanes so that taking your private car is so depressing in the morning, you know, that you're like, I can't sit in that traffic jam one more day. I'm going to get on the bus. So you can incentivize it by having really juicy parking spaces for carpoolers. As far as I know, and I really have no insider knowledge on this, you know, most people at UVA park by U-Haul, and so they have to get to work a half an hour early so they can shuttle over, and then they have the extra half an hour home time getting back to their cars. I have no idea if they could take their parking garage next to the hospital and devote some of those spaces to carpoolers, you know. Same thing with downtown. Or any private business, if you can make it really lucrative, or if you can financially subsidize people that are carpooling. I know businesses all over the country have done those kind of things. So right now, I don't know how many incentives are in place. You know, and the average commuter wants a bus to get them to work in about the same amount of time, more or less, as a car, with about the same cost. It's even better if it's less. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who would like to read or sleep when they're going to work in the morning on a public transportation. It just has to be reasonably similar. So I don't know if that means we need to have smaller, more frequent runs from population centers like Hollymead or you know, what have you, somewhere out on Pantops. From what I understand, the apartment complexes that are built south of Old Lynchburg Road that are in the county, some of them have shuttles to UVA and they're not used much. So, again, those students are thinking, well, the roads are small and the parking is slim, but it's easier for me to drive. So, again, even when there's a shuttle, it doesn't necessarily get used. Now, students have wildly variable schedules, and commuters don't. I mean, they pretty much all have to be at work by 9, they get off at 5, that kind of thing. And lastly, if I were going to do a pie-in-the-sky thing, I would wonder about jitneys, because when you go to foreign countries, there's always jitneys, which are just like minivans run by private individuals, and they just cruise a road, and if you stand on a corner, you know a jitney's going to be here within 5 or 10 minutes. And I have no idea if we have the population base, but I would certainly be open, if an entrepreneur wanted to do that, to licensing jitneys. So if you were down in Lovingston, you know, if you knew at 8 o'clock every morning a jitney's pulling up in downtown Lovingston and taking you to UVA and Barracks Road or whatever downtown, you know, I think any kind of private enterprise like that, or with the public system, is chicken and egg. In other words, people aren't going to start riding until it really works well, and it's not going to really work well until you have enough riders. So you generally have to have an operating loss for a while before you have to have a specified amount of time. We're going to know we have an operating loss for 6 months or what have you, and then we'll see if, you know, enough chickens are riding in the back of the van to make it viable. So that's my answer.
Okay. Are you ready to move on to question number 8?
Why not?
Excellent. Question number 8. What is missing in downtown's retail sector, and what might City Council do about it? What will your priorities be for development in and around the downtown mall, including the city-owned parking lots between Water Street and South Street?
This is one of those 20. You all are cheating a lot here with these 7 questions under one number. I think there's a pretty broad consensus that it's a food store that's missing, a grocery store. And if you look at some of the City Council work documents, they talk about a full-service, high-quality operation. And again, it's setting the bar too high. You know, these grocery stores are huge business operations. They have entire marketing divisions, and they do their analysis very carefully, and they figure out, do we have the traffic, do we have the parking, do we have the road size, do we have enough people that would shop here to make it worth our trouble to open the store? They've done the math. It hasn't added up. If it had added up, they would be here, you know? So, again, in a free enterprise system, you have to kind of respect that the marketers and the providers are voting with their feet. So then I would question whether the City Council work document that said we need a full spectrum, high quality operation is in fact a viable, it's a nice wish, it's back to Prince Charming, you know, but are you going to get it? And I think as we go towards higher density, and there really is a shortfall of places to go and get some kinds of groceries, then maybe we need to be thinking in a different way. You know, in New York, there's a corner grocery store on virtually every corner, at least in Manhattan. not in the Midtown, but generally speaking, you know, maybe we need more smaller operations. But again, as long as they're run by private business people, they have to make sense economically to those individuals. And I don't know if there's something we could do in terms of enterprise grants or something like that. I mean, it seems like we have lots of projects like that where we have incubator funds for things we value. So it may be that we can set up some kind of funding stream to lower the tax burden or to start people out with incubator funds for a smaller scale operation. I think a large scale operation like Kroger or Harris Teeter, I'm thinking, has done the math and it hasn't added up. So I think we need a different strategy. Is there more?
There is. The second okay. part of the question.
Downtown development.
Downtown development, including the two lots.
Yeah. The context in which I place development is that you have a choice, sprawl or density. You don't get to have neither. So in many ways, density makes sense. But you're going right back to, is there any such thing as high-quality growth? Because when things change, people react usually in a negative way. It's just our nature as humans. Nobody says, thank God a skyscraper is coming next door to me. I mean, why would you? You know, so I think density makes the most sense in the long run. You know, we're talking about where are people going to live? How are we going to expand our commercial base? It makes sense for there to be mixed-use development there. I'm fine with a height limit. To me, the specific issues that I would pay attention to, again, are the natural environment of the buildings. So, you know, are you going to lose the skyline 100%? I think there's some playful architectural things that can be done in building design that allow for better sight lines and horizon lines. I would like the street-level life of the buildings to be very inviting in some way on a human scale, you know, that so people are invited to pause and own the space, the street space, rather than just thinking, well, I have a bunch of bricks and windows, and at the end of the block, I'm done with this. So, you know, sometimes people have indentations for little green spaces or water spaces, play spaces. But to me, the most important feature would really be the street-level habitat of the buildings that go up, and to the extent possible, some way to stay tied into the beautiful environment in which we find ourselves.
Are you ready for question 9? I believe that you have everything there. Actually, I will just ask just a quick follow-up. Anything in particular about those two spaces, about the two lots at Water Street and South Street that are currently parking lots?
No, nothing else I'd like to add.
Okay, that's fine. Question 9. The City Council's 2025 vision statement identifies economic sustainability as a key objective. What do you think needs to be done to support that objective, and what role should government play to promote economic vitality?
Right now, the main sources of city revenue are homeowners' taxes and commercial. And a lot of it is homeowners because we have a limited commercial base. Now, maybe with more development, that'll shift a little bit. But it's nothing like the county where the commercial tax base is just exploding. So they can take a lot more of their revenue from businesses. So because we rely so heavily on homeowners, to me, the economic vitality really is sort of a backwards question. I want to be able to sustain homeowners and what they can afford to pay, and then the city's budget flows from that. Right now, we've been on a non-sustainable trajectory. We've had, since about the middle of the last 10 years, you know, double-digit inflation in the assessments every year, and that's been rising taxes for homeowners. And I don't agree with that. I would change it if I were elected. So we're talking about the city, but the city is funded by homeowners and funded by businesses. And so my focus is really more on how do you protect the economic viability of the homeowners. I mean, again, this is another hour kind of question. And this is my the short-term prong of my campaign is protecting homeowners. There's just been too much of an increase in people's property taxes and very little regard for them. There's been lip service but not so much regard for them. Well, how's that? Do you need more?
I think that answers the question. If you're ready for
sure
to move on. Question number 10. Do we have appropriate resources in city government to achieve the objectives in our strategic plan? In what way, if any, do we need to make changes? And what impact will your recommendations have on staffing and the annual budget?
Yeah. The strategic plan is a mix of reasonable, highly desired goals that are probably achievable, and some very blue sky kind of goals, like, wouldn't it be swell if we had this? And I'm not sure, it's nice to have dreams, but if you spend too much of a city's planning energy on the dream side of things, when they're very likely not realizable or perhaps should not be pursued, then I think you divert attention from what you can do, the more achievable goals. For example, let me just show you this if I can. There's something in the strategic plan. I'd like to read it so I don't say it wrong. It's on page 36 under the section America's Healthiest City. And you'll find with Charlottesville there's a lot of Ests. You know, we are quite taken by being first or most wonderful, or you have it. So here we are on America's Healthiest City. And it says, create a city-operated urgent care health facility. Contract for a turnkey operation that would provide option for employees to get medical care for simple medical conditions. Now, this is saying that the city would operate a city health facility for city employees as part of the plan. I can't support this at all. I think that's, my God, I mean, part of why we get a number one rating is because we have so many doctors per capita, and city employees have city health insurance. So we have the providers. We have the funding stream for employees to go to providers. How it makes sense for the city to use city taxpayer dollars to also open a city health care facility for city employees, this is the kind of remote vision that I would not support in the plan. I have a lot of problems with this. If you want to help people get access to health care, give it to the free clinic, for goodness sakes. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. But my global answer to this question is I think it's backwards. I think, you've taken what you want, and then you're going to figure out how to pay for it. And that's that consumption-oriented ethic that I described in the beginning of this interview, where our culture has evolved into one where we define ourselves by what we consume and what we surround ourselves with, rather than any sort of inner space, our inner lives. And so this plan, it's as if you took a homeowner and you said, and the homeowner said, well, I want to have a three-car garage and 5 flat-screen TVs and a vacation in Aruba and send all my kids to private school and, shop at Whole Foods every week and whatever. I mean, it's just this list of things that's out there, rather than starting the other way around, which is saying, here's my cash flow. This is what I have to spend. What are my budgeting needs? Am I going to have savings? Am I going to have retirement? Am I going to have a college education fund? Am I going to use infrastructure repair and be aware that my roof is going to run out in 2 years? And then what's left over? Do we get 1 flat screen TV, 1 private school tuition, whatever? So I feel that embedded in your question here is the reverse direction. It should be, what are our economic resources? And then, given the constraints of reality about our economic resources, what are our priorities? I think that the strategic plan is the opposite.
These are the additional questions now that you did not see until you arrived here. Question number 11. The County Board of Supervisors is currently reviewing the proposed Biscuit Run development at 3,100 homes. This would be the largest single development in the county's history. Do you believe Biscuit Run will be quality growth in our community? Why or why not?
Well, I've already told you what I think. Quality growth is like Prince Charming. You're not going to find it. It's certainly beyond my capacity to just picture 3,100 residential units. I don't know what that looks like. The problem is, again, we can have these discrete discussions, but they're embedded in a certain political economic matrix. And our matrix is that the people who owned that property, I guess they needed to sell it because the heirs were, you know, wanted their assets, are allowed to sell it. And so that's the done deal, is that private property owners can sell. And everything else is secondary to that. You know, there's a lot of talk about where's affordable housing. I have not seen the actual breakdowns of those 3,100 units, how many would be considered so-called affordable. But to the extent that they meet, you know, pretty much anyone's criteria for affordability, that's a good thing. I think the big nightmare is traffic. Well, there's two nightmares. One is just loss of canopy and unpaved areas and all that, but that's going to happen. I mean, you can minimize it. I know all developers say they need to clear cut, but you have to. But when individuals build on a lot, they save trees. You know, they say, no, I like that stand of trees over there. Make sure you don't take out those trees, and watch out for the roots of that oak tree when you put my house in. So it's obvious that it can be done, that you can build lots or develop lots and preserve the natural habitat that's there to some extent. To the extent Biscuit Run is cleared a lot, that will be a really a negative in the equation. I know they're putting in or want to put in a 400-acre park, et cetera, et cetera, but I think there's a lot of gratuitous loss of natural habitat. So there's the habitat issue and all the effect that has on water absorption, and then you have flooding and you have erosion and all of the habitat kind of questions. The other is traffic. And this is human beings at their typical middle, oh my God, zone. Where are all these travelers going to go? You know, they're talking about putting that connector road over the Sunset Fontaine connector road. And my thought on that is that's really great if when you get to Fontaine, you turn left and get on the bypass of the interstate. But if you turn right, it's right back to nightmares. You know, I mean, I understand that JPA is supposed to have widening, but it hasn't yet. Another thing nowadays, everybody wants their subdivision, their home on a cul-de-sac, you know. But that concentrates traffic and increases problems, as opposed to having multiple exits in and out of a neighborhood. It's just inconceivable. And so I think that that development should have lots of in and outs, and I know that that's not a committed to kind of process. And old Lynchburg Road is already so taxed and so inappropriate for high volume traffic that unless there's some really creative traffic planning that goes on, I can understand why they've suggested closing it at the city line. But of course, goes right back to part two of my campaign is, and why are we the city and the county? So if you want to be able to close on Lynchburg Road, you wouldn't want to merge. But it's going to be ugly, I think.
Are you ready to move on? Question number 12, what is your top priority for action by city council if you are elected?
Tax relief for homeowners.
Would you care to move on to question 13, or would you like to expand on that?
I just think we have had too many tax increases, and I think that the way tax relief is handled, in essence, comes back to one's political philosophy. And it appears to me that the philosophy of city council as a group is, in our wisdom, we will select those to whom we will give the benefit of tax relief. And that's not my philosophy. My philosophy is everybody gets it, because the people who earned the money are the people who should decide how to spend the money, not a governmental agency. And if you look at this process the city council has come up with, they've got the, you know, 8-point program for you might be eligible if. Again, it's too detail-driven and it's not user-friendly. No one should have to sit down after they have paid double-digit increases in their tax assessments for the last 5 or 6 years and say, let's see, I've got 1, 2, oh, I don't mean 3, I got 4 and 5. That's ridiculous. And then they came up with this thing they wanted to model after an Eastern Shore, a Tidewater kind of program where you could defer it until you sold it, but then they decided it was too hard. And again, this is where I would step in and say, oh, okay, that's too hard. Why don't you just simply cut the rate? You know, just stop taking it. That's pretty simple and pretty straightforward.
Question 13, if you're ready to move on. Okay. In your opinion, is the state government adequately funding our transportation needs? If not, what steps will you take to ensure priority transportation projects are actually funded and completed in a reasonable time frame?
When I read this morning, I thought, is this one of their trick questions? Because obviously, there's only so much you can do if you're located in city government. I mean, you need to be talking to your delegates, you know, Toscano and Bell and others. But once you're at the level of state government, your pull is much smaller. And from what I understand, there are a lot of appointed boards that weigh in quite heavily on how things go forward. And, you know, let's face it, if you saw my blog site, haskinsforconsul.blogspot.com, that's the F-O-R, not number four, money talks, you know, and our campaign system is, in essence, is about buying and selling candidates. You know, the big contributors pull the strings. And the big contributors and their progeny, as we say in medicine, are those are the people on the boards, by and large. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on these big boards that prevent common sense, consumer-oriented, citizen-oriented solutions to problems. And it doesn't matter what party the governor is with, the governor has people who paid for him to win, and he owes them. And it's just the way it is until we change our system. And so as long as you have powerful people appointed to powerful boards with vested interests that they're representing that are not citizen interests, there's really very, very little somebody like the city council can do. And that's why I think this is a trick question, because you're so politically sophisticated, you must know that.
Question 14. The University of Virginia is moving forward with numerous major construction projects to improve and expand their facilities. In what ways does this impact our community? And how would you characterize the level of cooperation between the city and the university? And in what way would you seek to make changes?
Again, a multifaceted issue. I mean, some of their improvements are in culture and the arts and athletics, and that benefits the community at large. I mean, part of, you know, why we're such a nice place to live is the artistic and cultural fabric of our life here. And to the extent the university is pursuing developments in those domains, they're adding to our quality of life. You know, going past the construction sites right now is a problem. Let me just look at this again. Characterize the level of cooperation. The university cooperates when they perceive it makes sense to them. And they play a very powerful hand. And actually, so do individuals. That we just play a less powerful hand. But we tend to cooperate when we think it makes sense for us personally. So the university is behaving the same way. They just have some really big, high cards in their hand. And as is pointed out, you know, they're the economic linchpin of this area, and so it would be remiss for me to only mention what they're not doing and not also mention what they are doing. But this is a relationship that has to be based pretty much entirely on seduction as opposed to punishment. You know, we can seduce the university into thinking that's a really good idea, we'd like to cooperate. But it's almost impossible to sort of punish them or sanction them into doing something we want them to do that they don't want to do.
Question number 15. The City Board of Architectural Review and the City Planning Commission have recommended restrictions on by-right building heights in the downtown mall, Water Street, and South Street areas. If elected, would you support ordinance changes that would allow 9-story buildings only with a special use permit? Why or why not?
Maurice Cox was in the paper not too long ago talking about the Cole Tower project, and he's obviously involved at multiple levels of planning and government, and he said that they changed things to by right a few years ago because nothing was moving forward, and they've changed it and things are moving forward. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that there's something about by right that sort of opened the gates for development. And so I would not go back to special use only.
Question 16, what are your priorities for improving the city's public recreational facilities and urban green spaces?
You haven't seen much in the paper lately about the YMCA and the pools. And it brings up this whole, let's see, the city and the county are supposed to pay equal amounts. We have less than half as many people as the county. We're giving the land. And this is fair. Why? You know, if we were doing the YMCA project, we're going to cut down our trees in McIntyre Park and match the county dollar for dollar. So I'm not thrilled about that. And surveys have shown that in the city pools right now, 28% of the users are city residents. But we've assumed the administrative and infrastructure costs for that. And then there was another study that came out that talked about how a survey of city residents showed that their number one priority was like a leisure pool or a warm water pool. And I think that that's a very specious, my guess would be that that's a specious questionnaire, because the people who answered it most likely, and I don't have intimate knowledge, most likely didn't have in their minds, well, let's see, we'll eliminate Crow and Smith, and then what would my priorities be? They probably assumed that Crow and Smith would continue to be in existence, and probably answered that as by saying, well, my next priority would be a leisure pool. So to drag that study out and say what residents want is a warm water pool, I think I'd really want to know the context of that survey, because I just think it's a mistake to get rid of both lap pools. I understand that the mayor has said, that he wants at Smith to have both a lap pool and a warm water pool or a leisure pool. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. If we really need to get rid of both of or change the lap pools because they're so aging, then I would support doing it that way, I think, and pairing up with the Boys and Girls Clubs more so than the YMCA project. Other than that, I know there's a lot in the strategic plan. One second.
No problem.
About just building fitness in throughout the city more, whether it's in the school system or having fitness courses and what have you. And those all make sense, assuming that the marginal cost is not prohibitive. Urban green space, I know in the strategic plan they're talking about having arborists as consultants to private citizens and what have you. To the extent we can, and I was talking a minute ago about when there's development, trying to maintain some kind of people-sized space, and people do relate to the green spaces, to natural vegetation, as well as to water and things like that, sky. So the more we can maintain our canopy and our green space, I think the higher our aesthetic quality of life here.
And the final question. This is question 17. What do you see as the primary responsibilities of City Council?
You know, it's sort of an obvious thing that we have disparate constituencies in the city, and so City Council is supposed to represent all of them. I think it makes more sense to have districts. You know, if we stay the city, which I'm not necessarily promoting, I think it's easier to represent different constituencies if you actually have delegates from those districts. I think you'll get a more clear voice, and then people just have to be able to negotiate. I think that you have to be a scrupulous steward of your cash flow. And so, again, I think the homeowners have just been abused and disrespected, and sort of it's been highway robbery with the tax increases in the last 5 or 6 years. So I think you have to have stewardship of your economic underpinnings, and to a large extent that's homeowners, and secondarily it's the commercial base. And so you have to do things to protect them. I think that city, you know, early on I talked about quality management and the belief system that you trust the people closest to the process. And we set up these hundreds of work hours to come up with an answer to a question, and then at times city council may be inclined to pick apart the recommendations. You know, they just had the purchase of the Dogwood housing, and Jim Tolbert's group had brought in Piedmont Housing Alliance, had worked on this for a long time. Everyone involved, and these are, you know, serious advocates for homeless people and, you know, people who need low-income housing. Everyone thought it was a fabulous project. And then it came before city council, and for a while city council got swept up into this, well, I don't think I like this angle, and, well, what about that? And to me, that just doesn't make sense. In that kind of a situation, Piedmont Housing Alliance is for people who need housing, who are disadvantaged. If they're saying, we love this deal, then why aren't you trusting them, for goodness sakes? You know, you're giving them millions of dollars. How can you not trust their judgment? So on the one hand, I think the tension in the responsibility for city council, on the one hand, is to do this right and to trust their advisors. On the other hand, though, and this is the subtle part and the judgment part, there are also dialectical forces of business as usual, protecting sacred cows, protecting turf. And so there are going to be recommendations that appear that, in fact, are not so much based on expert opinion as inertia or turf protection. And so city council has to somehow have the collective wisdom or the emergent wisdom to figure out when it's one and when it's the other, because they're very, very different. And you end up wasting a lot of money for the latter, but not for the former. And then I think it should have achievable goals. Yeah, it's, as I said in the strategic plan, I'm not into the 5 flat screen TV model of planning. I'm into these are our resources. Where do we go from here, and how do we do that? And then lastly, you know, I'm probably the only candidate that I'm almost like a poison pill candidate, because I really want us to talk about, should the city stay the city, which of course means should the city council exist on some level, because I think that's really, you know, we are 10 landlocked square miles surrounded by 690 square miles of the county. We have a very, very limited financial base. We have a huge service burden. We carry the torch for our artistic and cultural underpinnings. You know, we support the downtown mall. It just goes on and on. Just look at the cameras on the downtown mall, the $300,000 the city's paying for it. You know, anyone who comes here to enjoy downtown benefits from, if you believe it's a benefit, which is a separate discussion, but we're paying for it. So again, the city, endless examples, is paying a lot more in taxes. Residential property owners are paying 95 cents per $100 of assessed value. The county's paying 68. So you cross that line over by Barracks Road, you can pay one-third less taxes versus here. And so I just really want the city residents to be asking, is this for sure the way we want to keep doing things? Because what's the trajectory of doing things this way? Where does this get us 10 years from now, 20 years from now? You know, are we sure we want to keep doing this? So to answer the last question, besides what are the primary responsibilities of city council, I would also bring that dimension into it as well.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.